thank you guys very much. Very, very much. That was great. Would you also, I just have to say before we get started that I just love every single time I get a chance to listen to Dale Bruner teach the scriptures. I would listen to him teach that pesky chapter in Matthew 20 that you couldn't remember over and over and over again. It's always so inspiring to hear Dale preach. I was thinking today that my two favorite moments of the whole time was when Dale couldn't remember. You got the whole New Testament memorized. Matthew 20 must be just boring. I mean, if you don't remember it, something must be totally wrong in that chapter. Or when he sits there and talks about having a morning devotional reading Lowe's Ancient Classics every single morning, and then he looked at us as if we do that too, right? I was thinking, yeah, we're reading Jesus' Calling, and you're doing Lowe's Classics. But Dale, thank you very much for this morning. That was awesome. We say thanks to Dale again for just bringing it to us every morning. Great. So this evening we're going to continue on. Last night I began by talking about the entire idea of the principles of adaptive leadership, about the way in which we need to change the way we think about leading in the world because of the changing terrain around us. Sometimes when I talk about this, I'll talk about the distinction between stewardship and leadership. Many of us have been taught that stewardship is leadership. Now, I have nothing against stewardship. Praise be to God for people who take good care of that which has been entrusted to us. Stewardship is way better than not stewardship. But what we're beginning to recognize is that in a day where things are changing so rapidly, we need a different category, a different way of thinking about our charge as people who have been trusted with things and to take them forward into new land. And it's exactly what's at the heart of this quote by Leslie Newbegin. Remember, Newbegin, if you know the story of Leslie Newbegin's life, he was a missionary to India. He became a bishop in India. Matter of fact, he wrote about ecumenism because he was part of the World Council of Churches. He believed that the unity of the church was one thing that was necessary for the gospel to go forward. And he was worked in a time and in a place where, after spending his entire life and ministry and career in India, he came back to the United Kingdom and, in retirement, decided that it was harder to be a Christian in the United Kingdom when he returned than it had been in India. That the world had become so dramatically changed in the West that he literally had an entire career, an entire second ministry, trying to teach Westerners to think like missionaries. And that's exactly where we find ourselves today in our context, and that's the entire root of the missional church context, and that's where we find ourselves today in this changing world. And so this question, it just haunts us. If Western societies have become post-Christian mission fields, how can traditional churches become then missionary churches? What I want to begin with is to start with this notion. I believe that leadership is an action, that it's collaborative, that it can be learned, and that it requires transformation. The leadership is not about your role or your title, but it's about the way in which you function. The leadership is not something that you do by yourself. You may have the role or title, but to actually accomplish transformation and change is something that takes a group of people to do, that it can be learned, that it is a set of skills or practices. That many times when I talk to pastors about this, I say that it's a lot like preaching. You know, almost all of us probably preached or taught a message in the gospel before we got to seminary, right? We probably had some opportunity where someone entrusted us to give a camp talk or to do a young life chat, or did a Bible study for some friends, and someone probably tapped us on the shoulder and said, you know, you have some gifts or aptitude or ability. And then they recognized it and they said, but you better get yourself to seminary because you better learn about a deeper way of studying. You better learn exegesis and hermeneutics and homiletics if you're going to have a lifetime of doing this. And in many ways, even though we might have some aptitude or skills or opportunities, we actually need to learn some new sets of practices that are leadership. And that mostly and most importantly, it requires transformation. Tonight, I want to talk about the transformation of our practices, about a different way, a different process of thinking about leadership in the life of our church. And then tomorrow I want to talk about our personal transformation, the kinds of people that we need to be. I want to just begin by, before I start, I want to take just a moment, just a couple, to say, are there any questions left over from last night that you'd want to make sure that I answered? Let me just start. I'll try to use a few minutes at the end for questions on this, but since you know you've had a chance to chat and talk and think about it, are there any questions sitting there? Anything just rubbing you wrong or questions you need to clarify or... Please.
The thing that I kept thinking about as we were talking was that
Great. Yep. Yeah, the notion, that one of the questions to be pondering is the voices that are often missed. We're going to talk a lot about having to learn to listen to and bring other voices in to the context that we're not other seeing, and reframing it. It's a great observation and a great question to keep before us. Other questions or comments or, please. No, I haven't told you that yet, but I might. There's a couple of things we learned along the way, and one of the biggest pieces that we learned. Well, I'm going to hold that. I'll get to it as part of the illustration that we talk about, because the process is even more important than what I learned, to be honest. So thank you for that. If I forget, just remind me again. Anything else left over from last night? Okay. Well, I don't know what that means, but we'll push on. So. Alan Dutchman wrote a book called Change or Die. He literally studied people who were told, you need to change or die. You know, they were the kind of people who were told, if you have one more cigarette, one more drink, eat one more bacon cheeseburger, you will die. They were told by medical professionals or scientists or people who told them that you have to change your life right now or die. And when given a choice, most of you probably know this statistic. 90% die. It's an overwhelming thing to think about. We think that if we just have enough urgency, that if the circumstances is just bad enough, that of course we'll change. But what you realize is 9 out of 10 people, change is harder than death. Change is harder than death. We are so resilient. We are so resilient. Ed Friedman talks about the persistence of form. We are so connected to the way we've lived. We are so much defaulting back to our training that, according to Alan Dutchman, he looked at these studies and said 90% of people who are told to change or die, die. And so what he decided to do is study the 10%. The 10% who decided to change, and he decided to look at, so what was it about them and what actually helped cause the change? And what he discovered is what doesn't produce change are our three favorite things: fear, facts, and force. Right? I mean, when I saw this list, I thought, I don't know if I have anything else, right? I've got members of my congregation. One of the couples in my congregation, they grew up in Iowa. They lived their whole lives. They're these good, sturdy, hardy people. They can do anything. And Al always says to me, he says, Todd, the problem with your generation is you don't believe in shame. Shame and guilt did a lot of us a lot of good for a long time. You need to stand up there and shame and guilt us. We'll respond to it. And I looked at him and said, you know, your generation might have responded to it, but when fear doesn't produce change. It doesn't. Actually, they have whole studies on children who were, remember when we ever saw those studies about, remember when kids, we saw the films about like tooth decay? You know, they'd show you rotting teeth. And then what they found is kids would go home after seeing those films and they'd brush their teeth like crazy for like 2 days. And then they would regress back. It's the same thing they've demonstrated with using fear doesn't produce long-term change. Facts don't. We can show you fact after fact after fact. Exhibit A, the Presbyterian Church USA, right? Right. No matter how many facts you lay out about the fact that the denomination will die within a generation. It just will. It's just someone needs to do the math, right? You just calculate it out. It ain't going to last, and it doesn't change anything. Or force. You can't make people do stuff. You think you can, you try to, we hope we can, but authority itself won't. You can try to make people do anything and ultimately they will find their way around it. Fear, facts, and force don't produce change. What does bring change? According to Dutchman, three things. Relate, relationships, new communities, repeat, new practices, and reframing, new ways of thinking. You put people in new communities, doing new practices or ways of living, getting them to rethink their life in new ways, and they will bring change. This is at the heart of, say, Alcoholics Anonymous. New communities of people, new practices of living, new ways of thinking about your life. I have a dear person in my life who's an alcoholic, and he said, I have hundreds of memories, many of them great memories, of having alcohol. Birthday parties and ceremonies and anniversaries and weddings. I need 100 new memories of ways to be joyful and celebrate in this world without it, and I don't have them yet. New communities, new practices, new ways of thinking. And when we talk about shifting, reframing, what we're talking about is these things, this new ways of new communities, new practices, new ways of thinking. For those of us who are Christians, this should be great news because this is the Christian gospel, isn't it? Relate, new communities. There's a new community waiting for you. That's what baptism is all about. Repeat, new practices. This is spiritual formation. This is the way in which we live. We were once dead in our trespasses. Now we are alive in Christ, and so we live unto Christ. Reframe. Think your life again. That's the heart of repentance. A new way. Reconsider your strategy for living, Dallas Willard said, based on the reality of the presence of the kingdom of heaven. This is the gospel in a nutshell. So we should be the ones at the forefront of bringing change. Which I want you to think about for just a second. Actually, I'm going to ask you to do this. In a smaller group, I would do this out loud, but I'm going to actually ask you to do this. Would you turn to someone next to you and just answer this question? I'm going to give you 2 minutes, so each of you get 1 minute. What's one problem that you can't seem to get traction on? One problem that just stays in your church that seems like it doesn't change no matter how hard you try. One problem that no matter how much you work on it just seems to keep coming back. Will you just turn to someone next to you and share that about your church, your context, whatever you do? I'm not going to give you long, so don't be shy. Okay, so let me interrupt your problem sharing. Anybody want to volunteer? What's a problem that you can't seem to get any traction on in your life, in your church? What's one? Someone say. So getting enough Sunday school teachers, right? Good, good, good. What else? Leadership itself, right? How do you find enough leaders, the right leaders, the right people, right?
Discipleship groups, it's like trying to light a campfire in a thunderstorm.
Right, trying to get discipleship groups going, right? Right. People say all the time, we want to be disciples, we want the meat of the word, pastor, we want to make it. Yeah, right.
Keep them going.
Keep them going. Yep. Yep, good, good. Go ahead. Yeah, convince the leaders to give away leadership. Right, right, right. How do you? We believe in the priesthood of all believers. Where the heck are they? Right, right, right. Go ahead.
Trying to say self-identified experts refuse to stand down.
That's. Wow. Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead.
The general.
Yeah. Right. 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 Right, right, right. Other, go ahead. Yep, yep. Yep, yeah. It's amazing to me. You know, one of the things that I've done more and more with is I'm working with groups of churches that are in transition, like, you know, interim. And you read a CIF of a church that's like had 4 pastors in a row get run out of town, they still act as if they are like the first century church doing Acts 2:42 together, right? Trying to get them to talk that, you know, we believe in evangelism, we believe in reaching out to the lost. They haven't had a baptism in 20 years and the most lost people are the people on the session. And nevertheless, they've got these aspired values and then these actual things they do. How do you identify it and work them through them? Right, exactly. Anybody, one more. That's it, that's all they are. Okay, go ahead. It's like, Jerry, go ahead. Yeah, you can. It's another way that it shows up, right? Yeah, and so one of the things that you start recognizing is that the nature of our biggest challenges are systemic problems, right? They're much bigger. There's no silver bullet. There's probably not a single one of you who said, oh, I can solve that for you. Sunday school teachers, here's how you get them every single time, right? And what they always point to is that they are always, always about the organizational system itself, about the context itself. And one of the hardest parts about this type of leadership is that it must come from within the community itself, that in 2 different contexts, you'll have different results and different suggestions, even different solutions. So they're much larger, and we can recognize them, and they are the same kind of recurring pattern. And that's exactly why when we talk about what brings change, what's interesting about Alan Dutchman's response is he said that what brings change to the trickiest problems we have is that it needs relationships, new communities, whole new groups of people relating together, living out new practices with new ways of thinking, and here's the most important part, and they are radical. Tweaking doesn't work. Now, right here, I'm introducing you to a core concept of adaptive work, which is called competing values. We're going to talk a lot about the notion about the fact that you need to make radical change at a rate people can absorb. Leadership is disappointing people at a rate they can absorb, right? Ronald Heifetz also says that leadership is helping others to grow so they can face their biggest challenges. And right there we have the rub that we need radical, fundamental, sweeping change without being able to break this, without breaking the system. That's exactly the place that we find ourselves. The whole notion of technical and adaptive, just to remind you again, technical problems, they're important. We're going to talk more about them tomorrow. They're deeply important. You cannot do adaptive work if you're not competent at technical problems, but they are the application of current knowledge, skills, and tools. They're not these thornier problems we've talked about. Adaptive ones are ones that cannot be solved with one's existing knowledge, skills, and tools. They require people to make a shift in values, expectations, attitudes, or habits of behavior. Look at that phrase again, a shift in values, expectations, attitudes, or habits of behavior. Deep, fundamental shifts. New communities, new thinking, new practices. Deep, fundamental shifts. There's systemic problems with no clear answers. Kevin Ford, who I work with a bunch on this, has made an observation. He has said this because now TAG has been working on adaptive work with some of the leading churches in the country for about a decade. And he said, the transformational adaptive leadership is all about process. Too many pastors are beginning to use the language of adaptive, but they don't change their approach to leadership. And this is exactly the thing that I want to bring to you today. I've actually had a couple of people say, look, Todd, I've heard that canoeing story a few times. You know, we get the fact that we're in a changing world, so what can we do differently? And the very first thing I've got to do is you can say it's a completely different process of thinking about leadership than the way most of us were taught. Most of us were taught to be the experts who bring the solution, who line up the resources, who bring the best practices, and execute it. And now we're talking about having to lead and teach people to grow through a completely different process. So let me take you through an illustration. Stephen Ambrose said that when Lewis and Clark went into the uncharted territory, they knew less about it than the first guys who went to the moon. That the people who went to the moon had at least seen pictures of the moon, and that they had some idea of what they were going into. But for Lewis and Clark, that the uncharted territory was so uncharted, it was so they found creatures they had never heard of. They'd found flora and fauna that they'd never been discovered, at least by white folk. They came into a completely uncharted new terrain, and that in many ways, Lewis and Clark's experience is very similar to the more modern combination of Kennedy's moon vision, moonshot, and about his challenge to us to put a man on the moon. And let me talk a little bit about this. Many times, people use Kennedy as the example of what we want to be as a leader, right? Put a big vision before people. We will land a man on the moon and bring him safely back to Earth in this decade, he said in early 1960s. And it happened with 6 months to go, 6 month window. They were able to accomplish it. And we've always held this up as the power of a big vision, of rallying people to it. And sometimes even as pastors, we've been challenged. What's the vision? What are you going to rally people to? What are you going to hold up before people to have it? And here's what I want you to recognize. Kennedy gave a big vision and he gave a big speech. But the night that he gave his speech to Congress, he turned to Sorensen and said to him, well, that didn't go very well, did it? There was no overwhelming applause. There was no giant statement the next day in the newspaper. There was no rallying of enthusiasm. Kennedy's statement was one statement in the midst of a much larger systemic change that was happening. That started with the failure of the Bay of Pigs. Kennedy had a failure and he needed something to overcome it. That started with the anxiety caused by the Russians having beat them into space. And the sense that of the kind of growing sense of doom that we were falling further and further behind and what that could mean in terms of even military capabilities. He had a Congress who, because they were just desperate enough, were willing to support him and not sabotage and leave the money in place for this process. And mostly what he had was NASA, an entire group of people who were dedicated to experimenting, to working together and to trying to find a solution to a problem that nobody had even considered yet. Kennedy's vision statement was only one part of a much larger context. And for you and for me as leaders, this should be great news because it doesn't mean you got to wake up tomorrow and give the speech, give the sermon on Sunday that is going to rally your church to renewal. It means that you can start building all the different components, including some of the components that are the most terrifying at the moment, including some of some of our loss. At times, at San Clemente Presbyterian Church, I've had an amazing ministry. I told you, God gave me the desire of my heart by taking me there. But one of the most amazing parts of it was I think the church figured out. When I went there, I was 33 years old. My daughter was 3 months old. My son was 3 years old. I held her up and I basically said to the congregation that had just voted me in, you're all invited to her high school graduation. She's now a sophomore in high school and people keep asking her, honey, what grade are you in? We had just been through a very tough season in the life of the church. They'd lost half the membership. One of the members of our church was in charge, he was in charge of during the interim, because two of the different pastors had gone through divorces and there had been lots of kind of rumors and innuendos about their lives. One of the members of our church literally had to call all the young families who had stopped coming. He called 100 families who all told him that they were no longer coming to our church. 100 phone calls he made. The church had lost half their membership. They were in this difficult place. And I'm convinced that the day that they voted me, that they, the PNC sent out the brochure that had my picture on it, most of the members of our church said, my gosh, he's the age of our grandson. And what happened was amazing was they decided that they needed to support me because they had a sense that if I went down, they would go down. There was urgency. There was an incredible group of people who gathered around and they grew me up while I got to lead them. I had a great gift walking into that context of humility and urgency. We'd had our Bay of Pigs and we were nervous about all the other churches that were growing up around us who were taking away the families. There was a sense of openness to change. I had an amazing session that was willing to stay with us, and there was an amazing group of people who came alongside and learned with us. And that to fulfill any dream takes a team. Leadership is not about a silver bullet, one person, one expert, one speech, one talk, one moment. It's about a larger process of leadership. The adaptive process is the product. Richard Chait said that Harvard University has no strategic plan. Our only strategic plan is to think strategically about every decision. Our long-term goal is to have a long-term, healthy process for continually moving forward into the future. If I can give you anything else, I want you to think about leadership is learning a new process for being together. And it starts with a different perception. At the core of adaptive leadership is this basic fundamental action that Ronald Heifetz describes as looking from the balcony and listening on the floor. Spending time getting off the dance floor, up onto the balcony, watching the systemic issues at play, being able to take some perspective, to stand back, to gather your leaders with you and stand back and ask some of the questions about the underlying things that are going on in the life of the church, and then to go back down to the dance floor and to be engaged, listening on the dance floor, looking from the balcony, back and forth, back and forth. It's tiring. It's exhausting work. Because you have to both be deeply engaged with people, listening to their hearts and dreams, listening to the things they tell you, and then step back up and see the larger systemic issues all at one time. For many of us, we as pastors spend so much of our time down on the dance floor. We give ourselves credit, and we get credit for being close to people, being in their lives, listening with them, caring with them, walking alongside of them. We think about pastoring the people, but we often don't think about the fact that we have to actually step above it and pastor the process. And look at the larger scene above. To tell you how powerful this is, the NFL has a camera. I don't know if you know this. They have a camera that's called All 22. It's a camera that literally shows at any given time a picture of all 22 players at one time. It's so powerful, and the NFL refuses to release it beyond to the teams itself. There's actually been an incredible hue and cry amongst football fans to want that to become a feed, like a separate cable station. Because if you can actually see all 22, what you actually get to see is how many times Drew Brees misses the read. How many times Peyton Manning doesn't see the open man. You see all the problems. It's exactly the pictures that they show on the sidelines. When the quarterbacks come off and look, they're looking at the all 22 camera. It's that perspective. It's so powerful. The NFL does not allow the general public, even those to be able to see it, because it would take away the mystery of what they do. Think of how much time we need to spend as leaders being able to not only listen to our people, but pull away and get some perspective, looking from the balcony. It's that perception and that difference. Where in your life do you get the opportunity to stand back from your church and ask questions about the larger systemic issues that are going on? The music that's underneath the dance floor, the systemic patterns, the music that keeps us dancing. One of the pieces to think about, the stories that are told over and over and over again. Think about the things that started long before you and seem to continue even through you. Think about the resistance that people have and the kinds of biases and perspectives that they bring. That's the perception that we need to learn to listen for. Adaptive perception. Adaptive leadership then begins with this process. And here's basically the steps. And this will be on my website, and I'm going to take you through some of this today, and then I'm going to show you a video that illustrates this. So first of all, it begins with questioning default mental models. The first thing you do when you get up on the balcony is you begin to question default mental models. Second, clarifying through conflict competing values. Third, regulating the heat. Fourth, reframing for a new way of seeing. Fifth, learning to make blue zone decisions. And sixth, enact relationally. Let me take you through all of those one at a time. First of all, questioning default mental models. Remember, at the moment of crisis, you default to your training. So the thing you can almost always guarantee is that if you ever start brainstorming about ways to solve the Sunday school, the leadership problem, the discipleship problem, here's what I can guarantee you. Two things that I can guarantee you. The first suggestion is wrong. The first thing that someone says is wrong, because if it had been right, you already would have thought of it. And how often do we find ourselves right back into that spot, right? When I first came to San Clemente Press, I was brought to be the guy who would bring back young families. I had young kids. I was their solution. I was the strategy. We're going to hire you. You're young. You got young kids. Go get young families. I was visited by one of my elders on the day I moved in. He ostensibly came by to bring me a housewarming present. Then he sat down at a table with me, and he basically began to tell me about how his daughter was going to the other church in town that all the young people were going to, and he wanted his grandkids in our church and wanted to know if I would personally call his son-in-law so that his daughter would bring his grandkids back to our church. That's why I was hired. I was hired because you're young, you got those babies. If we bring you here, then you'll bring our families back, right? And that's, of course, what we're going to do. That was exactly the strategy. That's why we hired you. Go get them. We don't want to have to change anything. We'd like everything to stay exactly the same, except we want your young face up there with your young kids, and that will bring them in, right? Just they started showing up the next day. No. So I went to my staff, and I said, okay, so let's do some strategy. Let's figure out some things. How can we engage some of the younger folks in the life of the church? Let's start with the teenagers we have. We have hundreds of teenagers in our church. We had 3,500 teenagers had gone through our church program in the last 15 years, and we looked at the roll and realized that of those 3,500 teenagers that had gone through a roll, that we had less than 6 families that were in the life of the church. How do we go from having the biggest youth program to having no young families? So I said, so let's start talking about it. Let's brainstorm. And I turned around to my staff and said, what should we do? And somebody said, I know what we should do, Youth Sunday. That'll be awesome. I said, well, tell me, what's Youth Sunday mean to you guys? Oh, the kids do the sermon, the kids put on ties, they do the ushering, you know, the kids' band plays, it's awesome, you know, they're up front, the kids, I looked at them, I thought, wow, that's weird, that sounds terrible to me, but okay, if you want to do it, tell me. And I looked over, and everybody was all excited, talking about stories about Youth Sundays in the past, and how funny this was, and how great it was, except for 2 people didn't like it, right? Who are the 2 people who thought it was a bad idea? Number one? The youth pastor, right? The youth pastor thought it was a terrible idea. I look at the youth pastor and I go, why don't you want to do this? He goes, the kids hate it. The kids actually hate this idea. They don't want to wear ties. They don't want to be ushers. They know you don't like their music. They watch you out there not clapping. Shine, Jesus, shine, right? They know you don't like it and they feel terrible about it. Who's the other person who didn't like it? Now, the business administrator said it's called low attendance, low money Sunday. That's when everybody decides they're going to go visit somebody else's church. The attendance is terrible. Wait a minute, the congregation hates it. The youth hate it. Why are we doing it? Because it's the only thing we could think of. And how many times do we have programs in the life of our church that are defaults back to old mental model? Assume the first idea is wrong. Also, assert that anybody doing this, they're wrong too. Right? You know what we need? You know what you need? You know what we need? Anybody doing this, they're wrong too. Just assume it's wrong. Because if it was right, here's my point. It's not that they're wrong because we don't like them. They're wrong because if it had worked, it already would have worked. Right? If Youth Sunday would have worked, we'd all be doing Youth Sundays. It would have worked. And so what we have to, first thing we have to do is start by questioning all default mental models that we start with. You start by asking questions. Give up being the great answer giver and become a good question asker. If there's any skill that we need to learn over and over then, it's the skill of learning how to ask good questions. One of the guys in my church is a consultant. He gets paid a lot of money to be a consultant for high-level aerospace and technology. And I asked him, I said, so what is your expertise? He says, I have got one expertise, one thing I do. I'm the guy who figures out the question they're not asking. They pay me a lot of money to sit in the room with all the smartest people in the world, people who can figure out how to make, you know, Dreamliner jets fly most of the time, right? And I am the one who asks them the question. And he said, the most common question I ask is, I know there's a question in here and I don't know what it is yet. It's interesting. When was the last time you worked really, really hard figuring out the question that we're not asking? Practice becoming a great question asker. I don't know about you. Most of the questions I ask questions where I already know the answer. I do it almost as a way of trying to involve you, right? And the truth of the matter is there's all kinds of questions that we need to learn, particularly by beginning to question default mental models. Adaptive process and action. Convene conversations, especially with those who see things differently. Here's your Sacagawea. Who's the person who sees things that you don't see? Peter Block said, leadership is convening. When you gather people together and you ask their opinion, when you gather people together to ask a different way of seeing things, when you ask older folks what they think about kids, when you ask kids what they think about older folks, when you gather more convening conversations, especially with those who see things differently than us, clarify through conflict competing values. For most of us, this is the secret sauce, because most of us hate conflict. We are convinced that conflict is at the root of our problems, and for most of our problems, I believe, is that we don't know how to have healthy conflict. Genuine conflict that shows genuine competing values, like excellence versus engagement. Do we need a great band, or do we need a band that will help people feel more engaged in the life of our church? Do we need an excellent Sunday school? Or do we need Sunday school teachers who love kids deeply? Justice versus righteousness. This is my favorite denominational one. Most of us are smart enough to know this, right? We have most of our church fighting about justice, half the other church starting about righteousness. Justice, righteousness, justice, righteousness. Greek, it's the same word. Diakosune. So why are we fighting? What's in the conflict? What are the competing values at the heart of it? Why are we talking past each other? Stakeholders versus the unreached. Do we care about grandma? Do we care about our neighbor? We care about both. Who comes first? Last week, I had a couple come into my church. They said, we came to your church, and we want to meet with you, and we want to spend some time with you because we think we'd like to join. We've been leaders in lots of other churches. Mostly, we've been non-denominational our whole lives, and then we have lots of very strong non-denominational churches in my area. And this is the first time we've ever been part of a denomination, and we decided to come to you because we got so excited because we, for the first time in our lives, were at a Presbyterian church, and the reason why we're coming to visit you is because we heard a sermon by Tim Keller. That was a fun conversation. Right? So all of a sudden, they started asking me the question. So tell us, so now we had some people, we told them we started going to your church because we'd heard Tim Keller, he heard he's a Presbyterian, you're a Presbyterian. We heard you're that different kind of Presbyterian. I said, yes, I'm in the PCUSA. And all of a sudden, they told me their concerns. Theologically, they were uncomfortable with the progressive drift of the PCUSA. Absolutely. And I explained to them who we are and where we see ourselves and our mission and our purpose and why we are convinced, committed to being an evangelical presence, standing in the midst, that we're in a very healthy presbytery, that for our context, we're exactly where we want to be and that we're comfortable there and we're working it really hard and it's not always easy. And then she looked at me and she said, with a very kindly face, she looked at me and she said, you know what? I think if I'd have known that you were those type of PCUSA, the Presbyterians, we wouldn't have come. It might be better for you if you thought about not being with them. And I looked at them and I said, yeah, but you're not our mission. You see, you're leaders in churches already. You're already, I'm thrilled you came to our church. And if you didn't come because it'd be okay with me, you're not our mission. Maybe God brought you here to join our mission. Maybe the reason why God brought you here is to come stand with us in reaching people who don't care what the name or the initials are on the door because they don't even love Jesus. And maybe they're our mission. And they turned to us and said, that's why we're here. We're going to join with you. Now tell me what I tell my friends who wonder why we're joining with you. Because you joined the mission. Competing values. Come into the table, go into the world. Peace, unity, purity, competing values. Remember, competing values are always solved win-lose. Win-lose. There's loss in the middle of them. It can be 1-1A, but something's going to give. And they will be different in every context, and it will be different based upon your particular context. Let me give you an example just to show you what I mean. I love the backcountry. I love hiking. I love Yosemite, right? It's one of my favorite places on the planet. Yosemite has done an amazing job of protecting this incredible wilderness. We were talking about it at dinner today. And in Yosemite, there's basically one cardinal rule. The one cardinal rule is you stay on the trail, right? You got to stay on the trails. No cutting the trails. You got to stay on the trails. Why, right? You got to protect the wilderness. You can't have people running all over the trails. It'll destroy it. So you got to stay on the trails. They got one cardinal rule. If you want to protect this national park and the beauty of it, stay on the trails. It's dangerous to go off the trails, and you'll destroy the wilderness if you go off the trails. Stay on the trails. A few summers ago, I went to Denali National Park. Incredible wilderness. Deeply committed to this beautiful, preserving this beautiful wilderness. They have the exact same core value as Yosemite. Yosemite wants to preserve this beautiful wilderness, so does Denali. Denali has one rule and one rule only, no making trails. There are no trails in Denali National Park. For the same park rangers who work at Yosemite and whose job is to tell you where to hike and to keep you on the trails at Denali are not allowed to tell you where to hike. Because at Denali, they have so few visitors that they don't want anybody making trails. So if you go to Denali and you go up to a ranger station and you say, I'd like to go on a hike, they go, well, the bears are there. And if you'd like to just stay away from the bears, you have a lot of room. Feel free to hike. Just let us know when you come out of the wilderness. They will not tell you where to go because they do not want people making trails. Same value, completely opposite application, completely different context. Yosemite has so many people in California, they got to keep everybody on trails. Denali has so few people, they don't want any trails. Same values, same organization, two different contexts, two different sets of rules. I think very often, in the midst of competing values, we start to learn the deeper things that will not change, and we begin to work them through, clarifying through conflict the competing values. Jim Osterhaus, one of my colleagues in TAG, says, adaptive leadership for a pastor involves creating the environment in which the congregation can wrestle with the competing values and implications associated with the problem. And in many ways, this is exactly the work that we do now as pastors. We raise questions, we create healthy conflict, and we give the work back to the congregation so that they're wrestling with it to us, so that they understand their need for transformation and change. Conflict, this is the analogy that I use the most often. The key work of adaptive change is regulating the heat of conflict. So transformation happens this way. Think of a crock pot. You got hard vegetables and raw meat. You throw hard vegetables and raw meat into a crock pot. You have it all there together. If you turn up the heat too high, it all scorches, it all burns, and you throw it out. And some of us have done that. Some of us have been thrown out of churches because we turned the heat up too high. Or some of us have tried to bring change and believed our job was to light a fire under those people. And all it did is scorched it. And then they were more resistant. And then they went and got a pastor that would never bring change after us. We've been there. If you turn it up too high, it scorches it and it ruins it and it burns it and you throw it out. But if it's too low, then you end up with raw meat and hard vegetables. But the right amount of heat over the long period of time, brings a feast. If nothing else, learning that skill of learning to regulate the heat in your congregation, turning up the heat when it needs to be so that people will move, turning it down so that people can be able to stand in the middle of it, regulating the conflict, staying in the middle of it, holding up the competing values. We have to love this congregation and take care of these people. We've got to be great stewards of this tradition we've been given us. There are people outside our door that are not going to ever come back in here. How are we going to reach them and care for them? How are we going to be faithful to them in mission? How do we regulate the heat? And then reframe for a new way of seeing. And for most of us, this is the shift. For Lewis and Clark, it meant we're not looking for a water route. We're exploring a new land. We're not just trying to find a way to make sure that our nation is economically viable. We're going to try to find a way to give a gift back to the world of a world that they've never seen before. The notion of being able to reframe the context for a new way of seeing. In our church, what we decided to do is when I found myself meeting one time after another with people who believed that the way we would reach young families in the life of our church was through their young senior pastor, I had to give the work back to the congregation. And I had to help them reframe and think about it differently. And so what we began to do is talk about it this way. I said to the very same elder who came to me, who told me he believed it was my job to try to reach his son-in-law, I said to the very same elder, I said to him, look, here's what I want us to do, and I'm going to need your help. I want to create a church where you get to worship with your grandchildren. And that means we're going to have to reach together your daughter and your son-in-law. They're not going to come for me. It's going to take you changing. Can you help me transform our congregation so that your generation will transform the church so that their grandchildren can be with you? We're not going to have a young people's church or an old people's church. We're going to have a three-generation church. And so on 2 weeks after 9/11, when the stock markets had crashed, we stood in front of an entire group of mostly older people who had built the sanctuary, had built this entire campus. And we asked them if they would tear down all the buildings and pay for it so we could do a brand new master plan that would reach a brand new generation of people moving to town. There was no way we were going to reach young people unless the older folks were willing to pay for it. They had to be part of it. They had to see it as who they were. We weren't going to become a new church. We were going to be a three-generation church. And the reframe to being a multi-generational church opened up the possibilities so that all the conflicts, all the worship wars, all the conflicts about insiders and outsiders, give us a new frame for seeing the future. Do you want to be part of a church that your grandchildren wants to be part of? Yes. And what it's going to take is for you to pay for it. And that's exactly the transformation that began to happen. Reframe for a new way of seeing. And then make a blue zone decision. I'm going to talk more about this tomorrow. This book by Jim Osterhaus and Joe Drakowski, it's called Thriving Through Ministry Conflict. It's got a new paperback version called Thriving, A Parable for How Resistance Can Be Your Ally. It's called Thriving. It's the best book on ministry I've ever read. I now have permission from Fuller Seminary to use this book as a textbook in every class I teach, including practical theology classes, systematic classes. It's the single best book I know on ministry because what it talks about is the way in which conflict can be done in a healthy way. It's done as a parable. It's short. I've had my entire staff read it. I've now given it to all of my session to read. Jim Osterhaus has come and spoken to 70 of our leaders on it. And basically what he talks about is this. There's two ways of thinking about the way conflict affects you as a leader. In every conflict, there's either red zone or blue zone. Red zone is when you are activated by your survival, acceptance, control, or competence. Red zone is when we are operating and making decisions in the red zone, it's when we're trying to survive, make people like us, keep control, or demonstrate competence. And for most of us, we have one of these in our personality that's our default. You can probably spend a couple of minutes talking in a small group and pretty quickly get to what yours is. Mine's competence. I rarely wonder whether or not I'm going to have a job tomorrow for some reason. It doesn't ever hit me. I most of the time like most people to accept me. I don't struggle with control that much, but competence actually bothers me a lot. My big fear isn't that you all aren't going to like me. It's going to be that you're all going to say, well, there's an hour we're not going to get back of our lives. We could have done something else tonight, right? And so when I'm triggered by the idea of being incompetent, when I have to make decisions based on it, I will make decisions based on me. How many of the decisions that we make in the life of the church are built on pastors or elders or sessions, red zone, survival, acceptance, control, competence? Blue zone is when it's built on principles, values, and mission. Whenever you have to make a decision about adaptive change, it has to be a blue zone decision. So one of the very best things you can begin to do is begin to evaluate the degree to which the number of decisions made in the life of a church are usually built on red zone. If we do this, people will leave the church, they'll stop giving, and we'll go down. Right? If we do this, people will get mad. They'll be mad at the session. People will get mad at you, Pastor. If we do this, we know we're on the right terrain when we're having to make the decisions that are based on principles, values, and mission. 6 months after we brought TAG in, the recession hit us in San Clemente. And it hit us first. It hit us in South Orange County before it hit everybody else. It's only fair. We caused the housing crisis. We should probably suffer for it first, right? All of a sudden, we found ourselves exactly 1 year after we'd had a $100,000 surplus. We found ourselves having to face laying off 5 staff and 5 missionaries. Guess which was harder for the congregation? The missionaries. Not only were we having to cut back staff, but we were having to cut back beloved missionaries in the life of our church. One of the people we chose to cut back, we had to literally go find her in the jungles of Ecuador because she had no cell service, no internet, and she'd been ministering for a generation in the jungles. I gotta tell you, it's a bad day when you gotta go to the congregation and say, we gotta cut back 5 missionaries and 5 staff. It's a really big congregational meeting. And the only thing we had to go on was, we had a clear set of principles. Here's our mission statement. Here are the values. We didn't do across the board 10% cuts to keep everybody. We said, here's our principles, here's our values, here's our mission. And so when we let go our 62-year-old choir director who had been there for 19 years, it was deeply painful. Beloved man. Beloved. Most of the decisions we make in the church are usually built on who's beloved, who's in the jungle. Who can we tolerate letting go? First hired, first fired. We would make them based entirely on mission, principles, values. It was one of the hardest things we ever did. But 6 months later, our numbers were up. We had a new choir director that fit the job description we could afford to pay. Our ministry was moving, and we continue to move forward in our mission. Blue zone decisions cause people lots of pain, but they further the mission. And for most of us, we were never trained on how to think those things through. Make a blue zone decision. What furthers the mission? What principles are at stake? What values are we expressing? And side with principles, not people. This is the one that's going to keep you up tonight and you're going to wonder about. We side with the principles because the principles are that which we found on the balcony. It's the ability for us to look out and say, this is what God's calling for us to do. Very often when I'm coaching pastors and they're going through this process, they'll say to me, look, this is my biggest fear. We're going to get in the middle of this thing and we're going to figure out that either I'm not the right pastor or I'm going to leave or someone's going to want me to leave. How are you going to protect me? And here's my answer every single time. I'm not. What I'm going to do is make sure you figure that out before anybody else. I'm going to help you know your principles, your values, your mission, and the churches as well. And if there's a gap, you will lead them in such a way that we can trust it'll be good for you and good for them. I'm going to side with the principles of mission even over you, this person who I coach, who's contracted with me to be with them through it. That's the only thing I promise you. And that's what we have to promise our churches. The mission of the kingdom of God is at stake. We are going to go forward. We are going to put the mission of Christ before everything. We're going to love people and care for them and take care of them. We're going to go at a rate people can handle, but we are going to make decisions based upon our mission, our vision, and what we're called to do, our values. And that will be the hard work for us. I tell people to pay attention to purple. Notice what tends to make you go red, and then strive to be the least anxious presence in the room. If you can pay attention to your own red zone and blue zone, we'll talk more about this tomorrow, then you have a gift to offer to everyone else. If you're the least anxious person sitting in the room, when everybody else is anxious, then you've got a gift to give them. When you can hold up the values and principles and the mission in the middle of it all, then you've got something else that you can offer people who else are getting stopped in the midst of the transformation. Notice what makes you go red, pay attention to yourself, and be the less anxious presence in the room, and you can move them toward a blue zone decision. And then enact relationally. I have an entire hour that I do on this that I won't do for today, but so that you'll have these in the notes later. The entire function of blue zone work, here's the huge irony of adaptive work, is it's all about principles, but it only succeeds through people. It's all about discovering and discerning the way in which the world has changed and being able to move forward into the future, but you do it with people. You have to find allies and confidants. You have to support the people who are changing along with you. You've got to work with your opposition. You have to be able to accept responsibility for your piece in the mess. You've got to be able to stand right in the middle of it and acknowledge loss and model behavior and accept casualties. It is a deeply relational work. As the folks from the Lombard Peace Center say, your job is to be able to stay calm, connected, and stay the course. Now, what I want to do is give you an example, and give you a little pop quiz. If you have seen the movie Moneyball, this is good homework for adaptive work. Literally, the phrase "adapt or die" shows up into it, and I want to show you a scene which my covenant group calls the session meeting. See if you can recognize the difference of this.
We're trying to solve the problem here, Billy.
Not like this. You're not even looking at the problem.
We're very aware of the problem. I mean...
Okay, good. What's the problem?
Look, Billy. We all understand what the problem is. We have to replace...
Okay, good. What's the problem?
The problem is we have to replace three key players in our lineup.
No, what's the problem?
Same as it's ever been. We've got to replace these guys with what we have existing.
No, what's the problem, Barry?
We need 38 home runs, 120 RBIs, and 47 doubles to replace.
The problem we're trying to solve is that there are rich teams and there are poor teams. Then there's 50 feet of crap. And then there's us. It's an unfair game. And now we've been gutted, like organ donors for the rich. Boston's taking our kidneys, Yankees taking our heart, and you guys are sitting around talking the same old good body nonsense like we're selling jeans, like we're looking for Fabio. Think differently. We are the last dog at the bowl. You see what happens to the runt of the litter? He dies.
Billy, that's a very touching story and everything, but I think we're all very much aware of what we're facing here. You have a lot of experience and wisdom in this room. Now, you need to have a little bit of faith and let us do the job of replacing Giambi.
Is there another first baseman like Giambi?
No, not really.
No.
And if there was, could we afford him?
And the answer, of course, is no. And that's the problem. Now, most of you know the story about the Oakland A's. We're in their home territory. They don't... What's that? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, really. So here's the question I want to ask you. If you think about this as a... What Billy Beane did was a classic example of reframing adaptive behavior. He figured out, how do you take a small market baseball team and compete with teams that make millions and have much millions more revenue than they do? So which did Billy do? What did you see here in this process? He asked questions, right? And questioning, particularly he questioned the default mental model. Here's exactly what you have to do, right? What else did he do? He regulated the heat. He was turning it up on them, right? Their complacency. My favorite part of the whole thing, you need to have a little faith in us, Billy. How many times have you sat in a session meeting and had your elders tell you, you know, you just need to have a little bit of faith. If maybe we just pray, that problem will go away. Maybe we just, right? What else did he do? He did most all of them, actually. He didn't really enact relationally. I'll tell you about that one later. But, I mean, he actually ended up having to fire the head scout. The point I want you to recognize is the kind of conflict we saw around that table, that kind of constructive conflict of rethinking through, is one of the skill sets that we have to develop when we're no longer the expert, but we're leading the process of transformation. We have a huge mission out there, and here's one more exercise that you can think of. Let me just give you one more way to practice this. This is the way in which we tell people to practice adaptive capacity. It starts with three steps. There's a problem. You identify the problem. We don't have Sunday school teachers. We can't get leaders. We can't get people to be in discipleship groups, whatever it is. It's an ongoing problem. What do people do? They go right for interventions. I know what we should do. We should do this. Youth Sunday would be great. We should try this. We need communication. This is my favorite one. Anytime anybody ever says it's communication, here's a secret. It's not. It's not. How many times in the church do people say, you know, if all we had was a pulpit announcement? Oh, is that just me? Am I the only church that ever thinks that if the pastor does a pulpit announcement, it'll solve all the problems? Right? I keep telling you, if the pulpit announcement solved all the problems, everybody in our church would pray and ski, because I always announce the prayer meetings and I like skiing. And yet we don't have a church filled of prayers and skiers. But we think it's about communication. Communication is always, it's something else. So the first thing we do is, instead of going for interventions, you start with observations. Notice, plural, observations. Get as many people around to observe the problem and gather them together. Then teach people to observe like a soccer game. When I do this with groups of people, they can't help themselves. They immediately go, I'll say, so what do you think makes it hard? What's the problem we have with discipleship in the life of the church? And immediately people will go, the problem we need is we need better teachers. Okay, I didn't say interventions. I want the observations. Getting people just to observe. Well, Sunday school classes used to be better attended back in a day when more generations of folks were raised on Sunday school. Great, what else? People say they want discipleship groups, but they don't want to rearrange their lives. Great, what else? And press for multiple observations. And then press for multiple interpretations, because the first one is usually wrong. And then after having multiple observations and multiple interpretations, attempt playful interventions. Don't hire new staff, don't raise lots of money, don't tear down buildings. Try simple, playful interventions. Thomas Friedman said the biggest problems of the world are going to be solved with 100,000 people in 100,000 garages doing 100,000 experiments until 5 of them work. My biggest problem with 1,001 new worshiping communities, I told Roger Dermody, who's my friend, he should have called them the 10,001 failed worshiping communities. We should have prided ourselves in doing 10,000 experiments rather than 1,000 successful ones. How can the church become the place where we begin to experiment with the future, where we call people together and give them raises because they did 3 failed experiments last year? instead of staying with the same stuff that worked over and over again. Observe, interpret, intervene. And notice it's plural. Observations, interpretations, interventions. If Western societies have become post-Christian mission fields, how can traditional churches become then missionary churches? It's a huge topic. It's a transformational topic. It'll take every single church, wherever we are, and every single new pastor coming in to plant every new church to be able to solve this. And it's not going to happen through the exact same process as before. All right, now any further questions for tonight? Please.
You talked about principles, values, and missions. I was wondering if you could just clarify what you mean, what the difference between principle and value.
Principles, values, and mission. Yeah. What I mostly mean is in every organization, you have certain things that, remember we said, once you determine what will never change, then be prepared to change everything else. So some places, the values are these things that are never going to change. These are the core values. There are theology. They're the things that we're behind. And sometimes the principles are the principles that we have adopted because they're core to who we are. So in our church, our values are very clearly our theological, biblical stance. I couldn't change the theological stance of our church even if I tried. It's so deeply enriched. That's one of the healthiest parts of who we were. If I got up tomorrow and changed my theology, the church would kick me out after 16 years. It's that embedded. It's that healthy. It's that good. And that's when you know your culture is resilient. Is it so resilient it stays there, right? One of our principles is that we're going to be a multi-generational church. And that we're going to reach young families. And that's one of our principles that became very clear during this season of time. And it guided us all the way through those transitions. But if the circumstances changed, there's probably principles behind that. And the real principle behind it is that we're going to be a church for our community. So if there wasn't children in our community, if all of a sudden the demographics changed, it would be less about children anymore. That's not one of our values. Our values is that we're going to be a missional church that reaches our community. So the principles can be a little more fluid. But what we're talking about is in either case, we're talking about the things that are big, enduring, agreed upon, strategic, the things that limit who we are. And in many of our churches, one of the biggest struggles we have is we don't want to ever limit ourselves. You know, I work with one church. It's a struggling, great, beautiful little church, but their mission statement is that they want to change the world for Jesus. I'm like, I'd like you to change your block. You know, I'd be really happy because I do think that sometimes our grand visions are just work avoidance. They keep us from being able to reach the neighbors around us, right? I mean, it's amazing how many churches we have, how many people who have huge vision, but it actually keeps them from loving the neighbor. And so where our principles and our values and our mission come is that's the rub that makes us make the hard decisions. When I talk about our choir piece, one of the biggest pieces we had to deal with is we are in South Orange County and we do not have a really huge choral music tradition. So, I mean, I came out of Hollywood Press where there was this giant choral music tradition. We have a really good choir. But our choir really is a bunch of people who just love singing their faith. And they don't need a full-time choir director. What they needed was what we got, a really great part-time high school music director who loves these people and helps them sing their faith. Now that's different than if it was with my pals over at Trinity Press, where they have this huge tradition and history of really great, excellent worship. We're never going to be them. We're never going to be St. Andrew's Press. We're never going to be them, but we're going to be us. And if we start aspiring to things that aren't us, it's another way of doing work avoidance. It keeps us from being who we're called to be. Other questions? Go ahead. Jim. Thank you for asking. And I tell this story all the time because this was the most gut-wrenching, difficult one we ever did. And I know there's folks in the room who know the story. Here's the thing, the piece about that, Jim, and I really appreciate asking it. there's two parts of it. One is there was a long process of actually honoring him, taking care of him, and caring for him. And as a matter of fact, in many ways, he was the kind of person, because he's this amazing, great guy, he was, in one ways, one of the examples of the kind of person we wanted to care about. I remember when we made the decision, because a man walked into my office and said to me, look, my father worked for JCPenney his whole career, and he was fired 2 years before his retirement. And I've never walked into a JCPenney since. How do I show up for worship on Sunday? All we could do is I could look at him and say, we made the best decisions and we tried to be as caring as we could and as generous as we could and give as many options as we could. I'm not going to tell you all the details, but we made it as absolutely fair and right as we could. But there came a moment when basically I actually said to the session, the principle we're building this on is because we believe this is what God's called us to be as a church. My only hope would be that if a day comes where you need to have the same conversation with me, you'll be as fair and generous as me as I believe we're being with him. Now, I have no qualms with a church that would have said our principle at that moment would have been to side with a person. That's who we are. It would have violated our code or whoever we are. But for our church at that moment, what we needed to decide, just like Denali says we're not going to have, you know, trails, is we need to decide that for the mission of this church to go forward, and he wasn't just the only one. He was going to be a person who was going to be let go. We did it in a way that as generous as we could, as best as we possibly could, but there's no way to mitigate against that. And if a church decides this is a principle, my only take about it is if we decide we're going to choose this person, then that becomes your principle. And that needs to be as consistent as with everything else you do. So I'm more interested in the consistency of your sense of mission. And I think it's okay. I mean, I really do. I don't have any qualms with churches who say we've chosen this. One of my pastors says, I pastor a church where I now know my job is to love and care for these people who are not going over the mountain. They've said they're not going to go. So I've said, if you can have an honest conversation about dying well, about giving a legacy to the next generation, about maybe taking care of the plant and passing it over, about thinking about beyond what it means, then you're probably doing a good work. I mean, I think there's a lot of our congregations that need to have really good hospice care and really good legacy planning. When I came to San Clemente Press, I said to them, they said, you know, why should, their last interview question they asked me, they said, why should we hire you? And I said, well, I can't tell you why you should hire me, but I should tell you this. If you don't hire somebody like me who wants to do the things we've said, then what I think you should do is you should hire someone who's going to take care of this congregation for the next 20 years, and it will slowly die. Retain all the assets you possibly can. Do everything you can to take care of it and prepare it to become the most vibrant Hispanic church in South Orange County. Because maybe that's what God wants to do. It's just as equally faithful as what we're going to do. I really am okay with people discerning their vision and their mission and then executing it, and they could be different. But our principle that moment was for that moment. So siding with principles might mean this is the kind of person that we are, but let's be really clear that it's not just because we feel bad, it's because it becomes a principle, let me put it that way. So, and it was painful, it was hard. That's why I use the example publicly, it's because I want people to get that, I mean, that was not my favorite day. Absolutely. Yep. Yep. Right. The answer is to hold up the competing values. And here's how you know you're dealing with competing values. They're both valuable. I've done this exercise with people. I tried to do this with a group of people once, and they were trying to, and you can tell when people are not being honest is when they start framing the values weighted, right? So what are our values? Our values are boldly going where the gospel takes us or security and self-interest. No, those aren't values, right? Competing values are what I wanted you to try to catch when I told you that we're a church that's about our future, but we're taking grandma with us. Because I love our older people. But I want our older people to get that more and more and more as we reach new folks, we're not going to be programming for you. We're going to love you and care for you and create a congregation that loves you and care for you, but we're going to be investing more and more in the things we've decided on are our mission, including maybe someday replacing your pastor with somebody who fits the mission better. The mission is going to win. And that holding those values together and holding up that tension so that it hurts so badly is the only way to know we're doing it honestly. It's the only way to know. Go ahead. Yeah. Right. 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 Well, and I think this is the point. I mean, this is the moment in the room that I'd like all of you to go, oh, I can do that. Because what we're good at, especially Presbyterians, we're doing a lot of dying, right? What we're good at is helping people deal with loss. So how do we do it when we help people deal with loss? Like when you look at a woman who's lost her life. I mean, I have a couple in my church, they just celebrated their 65th anniversary. 65 years. I mean, they came up on Sunday morning, I hugged them, and I had two thoughts. Number one was, God, I hope God gives Beth and me 65 years. And number two is, oh, how excruciating that's going to be when I got to do one of their funerals, right? I mean, the great news of spending your whole life loving someone till death parted you is that someday death's going to part you. And it's, we are great at living in that. That's what we've learned. We're actually experts at it. So we need to claim that and step in the middle of it with as much courage for systemic and organizational loss as we do for personal mortality and limitations. Let me put it in another way, and this is always a little more controversial, but you'll like this. I think it's one of the reasons why big churches struggle with making change. Big churches usually have enough money that they can avoid the loss. For years, we were. We could afford to keep people on that we couldn't afford. The recession hit and made us make hard choices. So one of the biggest things I've discovered with the larger churches that I work with is they've lost the capacity for making hard choices because they could solve every problem with addition. We can hire a new pastor. We can hire a young adult person. We'll hire another chaplain to the older people. We'll hire an assistant associate director of spiritual care for people who've got little kids. Right? We can add to it. And what happens is those of you in smaller churches, you have more capacity. You understand this. You live with the limitations. And this is one of the reasons why we need those of you who are working in smaller churches to be kind of mentors for those of us in larger ones about how to deal with limited resources and how to be able to have hard conversations about it. I worked with a larger church one. The guy looked at me and said, for 25 years, we've solved every problem with addition. We have no idea about how to make a hard choice. That's a lack of capacity. But if you, that's just the same way as if you've never had to deal with grief or loss or death, then when it comes, it's really hard. We have, that grief work is at the center of what we do. We're after, it's 9 o'clock, so I'm gonna take one more question. You get it. Well, actually, you were standing up. I'll take two. Let me go here and then you. Oh, go ahead.
In your opinion, why did non-denominational work
so well
in attracting
young families? Would you give the same talk to them? I don't know if I agree with that premise. I'm not sure. I'm not sure I can answer that one. I'm not sure about the non-denominational attracting young families. Because in our... Well, in our community, that was one particular couple. I have to think about that. Let me think about it. I'll talk with you about it. Maybe I'll come back to tomorrow. You in the back. Go ahead.
I just want to make a comment to the comment you just made about the ability of small church pastors.
Yeah. Fair enough. You're right. Right. True.
And we heard, I'm now retired, but I think one of the problems with the nomination is that numerical prejudice.
Right. Right. And actually, it's a great comic, and I think this is one of the things that's absolutely changing, is that we recognize that the future is going to be one. I mean, there's. I tell my directors, the people on my staff, look, the odds of you getting an associate pastor position in a large church, you ain't going to get one. Because the associate pastors in large churches in the future are all going to be senior pastors who decide they don't want to be senior pastors anymore. So you guys coming up through the trenches, your job is basically you're going to become the pastors of either your plant churches or you're going to turn them around. You're all missionaries. We got to prepare you for it. It's all going to be in church planting, and it's going to be in turnaround churches, and that means in about within 10 years, you're going to be the experts, because that's where the future is. The future is in the small church or in the new church plant. It's in the renewed church becoming a missionary church or in the church plant. That's the future. And I'm just believing it, and I'll be glad to be there sitting beside you when a different panel of people are there. I'm going to close because it's after 9. I'll be glad to talk to me. Let me close in prayer, okay, and then we'll be finished. Anybody wants to talk, I'll hang out for a few more minutes. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about ourselves. Tomorrow night, we're going to talk about what it takes for us. But I want to close in prayer by praying for you and for me. Lord, these talks have a sense of heaviness to them and a sense of urgency. But I pray they'd be infused with a hope that you are teaching us, that we are learning. I pray that you'd give us that feeling that we had when we first discovered that the scriptures could be unlocked. I pray that you'd give us the sense of enthusiasm and an insatiable appetite for learning that first came when we first realized that we could lead teams of people deeper, that we could sit at a bedside with someone who was grieving, and that we actually could offer something of ministry and service. I pray that you will keep raising up a generation of new leaders who are willing to go into uncharted territory, and that you'll help us begin the process of learning new skills, new ways of thinking, of new ways of relating, new practices, new thinking. Help us to think differently. Help us to hold tightly to the things that matter, to the things that should never change. And help us to grieve and let go of all the other things that compete. Bless us this night, our conversations, our sleep. Prepare us for this next day. Thanks for this place and this space. In the name of Christ we pray. Amen.